KALW.
When I interact with Lulu, I'm learning her language, and then she's learning my language.
Wendy Reed composes music that's designed to be interrupted.
If I really want to do something with her, I'll go, Lulu, you know, something like that, and try to inspire her. See if she... Lulu.
We'll hear her interspecies sonic landscapes. Then, is cancel culture a kind of modern moral panic?
In a way, we're never quite encouraged to ask, well, okay, so a bunch of sophomores at Oberlin were mad about the sandwiches. Why do I know about this? How did this get to me?
It's a new episode of Book It. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Before a musician performs, they rehearse. They play the same notes over and over again until they know exactly what to expect. But what if the performance is interrupted by the wind in the trees, a child in the park, or the squawk of a bird? For composer Wendy Reed, these interruptions are the point. Reporter Julia Haney went to Berkeley recently to listen to Wendy and her co-composer Lulu perform.
So have you performed with Lulu before?
Yes. Like, we did something in Oakland, like, maybe around 5 years ago or something.
Lulu is amazing. She has an incredible repertory of sounds.
You've seen Lulu before.
Well, I've seen Lulu before, yeah.
From what I understand, Lulu's got a bit of stage fright sometimes.
The first time I meet Lulu and hear her sing is at Live Oak Park in Berkeley under a small redwood grove. She's just about to start warming up with the rest of her ensemble and her co-composer, Wendy Reed.
It's perfect for music, I think, and that the kind of music I do, I should say.
Wendy and Lulu have been making their kind of music for years, and sometimes performing it live. The people that have come to listen today crouch on the stairs or settle into the grassy bank high above the musicians.
I do like the fact that it's not a regular performance space, that I've kind of created this, and that odd group of people will end up there as a result. It won't be just the people who are coming to a concert.
At first glance, this event doesn't look so odd. A dozen ensemble members are dressed in black. There's a tuba, a flute. Everyone is settling in as the musicians start warming up. But I can't discern a tune. One group member blows into a long metal tube. Others scratch their instruments softly. They all form a semicircle around the star of the show, Lulu, the one so many people came here to see. But Lulu is still quietly observing, unassuming. She seems only barely aware of all of the eyes on her.
The score itself is based on Lulu's and my interactions. We improvise a little bit, probably every day. I'll try to imitate her either on my violin, sometimes I do it vocally, and then we kind of create these concoctions. So it's not really I'm transcribing her, I'm transcribing us, and maybe I'll slightly change it if I feel like it. As a composer, I'm allowed to do that. And so I have a whole series of these.
Wendy and Lulu have been making music together for as long as they've known each other, 18 years. This series is called Ambient Bird, because Lulu is a bird, an African gray parrot. At Wendy's home in Berkeley, Lulu's crate is right next to the door, surrounded by stacks of books and records. She's gray with light eyes and a bright red undercoat. And she likes being sprayed with water.
Sometimes she starts talking. Let me see if she'll talk. Okay.
Okay. It's hard to hear, but Lulu is imitating our laughter. And doing a very good job.
The laughing is like human, you know, scary. That's pretty. Most of the things she says are things where someone's calling her cute or pretty girl or beautiful bird. She has all those down. And she also, you know, if you get too close to her, she'll bite you. And she'll know you'll say ouch. So she says ouch before you. And then she'll start laughing because that's what people do. So she's picked up all these kind of interactions with people and how can she entertain them. But it's kind of embarrassing because it's not her intellectual side. It's her conniving side, really.
Wendy's been making music with animals for decades, including a parrot named Choo Choo and her dog.
I've had different birds in my life. I've had different animals in my life. I have a couple of pieces with some dog barks. That dog didn't have the vocabulary of a bird, so she wasn't going to be featured in all my pieces. But all the birds that I've had have been featured in my music since 1980.
Birdsong is embedded in Wendy's earliest memories of music, when she'd go to her grandmother's ranch in Wyoming and escape to a nearby forest with a creek to play her violin.
The ranch was a little bit like that performance space. It was surrounded by all these trees and in a creek. I never thought about that parallel until just now. And I'd go out and I'd play my violin and just kind of play around with my violin and the music I knew. I actually didn't want people to follow me to hear me play. I just wanted to be out there by myself and do my own thing and not be thinking that I have to perform for somebody.
At home, Wendy and Lulu spend time listening to each other and responding. Wendy records their interactions. Their composing process is spontaneous and unique every time.
There's no steps. There's no steps at all. She does everything. She starts it. She initiates it. If I really want to do something with her, I'll go, you know, something like that, and try to inspire her. See if she... She won't do it. You know how you kind of yell to somebody when you want to just hear their voice. Sometimes it erupts into something really big or not.
Lulu's a little shy when I visit. But Wendy says when she's teaching violin at home, Lulu loves to chime in.
When I'm here, you know, teaching, she is not shy at all. She's over there in the other room, and she's squawking away. She's singing. She corrects notes. Sometimes somebody's playing a little out of tune, and then she'll throw them the right note, and I'll say, just like Lulu, a little bit higher. You know, when a teacher corrects you, it's much more intimidating. But when a bird is correcting you, it's funny and humorous. But you get the same kind of, you know, instruction, really.
And Wendy is adamant that the bird is not a sound effect. She even credits Lulu as her co-composer.
I think of her as an equal when I write a piece of music. She can't write the notes down, but she's definitely creating the ideas with me.
In the materials for the Live Oak performance, Lulu's name is listed before Wendy's. Wendy introduces the performers one by one. Then she picks up her violin and the music starts. But with all the eyes on her and so many interesting sounds, Lulu tends to get a little stage fright. And Wendy is prepared for that. She plays recordings of Lulu alongside the live music. Because the performance is happening in a public park, many people are just here to walk their dogs or lie in the grass. These park sounds intermingle with ambient bird. And for Wendy, these sounds are not interruptions, but part of the reason she loves performing in these kinds of spaces and surprising the people that come here, like Joe Silber.
I mean, I just stumbled into this with our kids. I think it's a human-bird collaboration. We were watching our kids. You know, kids have that confused look, and we were thinking that, like, this song is, like, what's always happening in their heads.
And though they weren't paying attention to the performance, for a moment, the kids became part of it.
That's exactly what I want in this piece. I want that ambient sound of people just living their lives as this odd little piece goes on.
Today at the creek, Wendy doesn't mind the audience.
this point now, I'm pretty much as if the audience wasn't there, you know. I'm kind of exploring and not letting the audience inhibit me too much. I was kind of like always wanted to explore new things. And so if somebody thought it was stupid, that wouldn't have any effect on me.
The kids, the dogs, the water, the cars whizzing by, the wind in the trees, it's all part of Wendy's composition. It also feels like a celebration of her relationship with Lulu and of the liminal human-bird world that they've created together.
I always call her half human and I'm half bird, and that's exactly what it is. She's taught me so many things, and my kind of human level of, you know, interacting with her has taught her all the interesting sounds that happen as a result. When I interact with Lulu, I'm learning her language, and then she's learning my language.
As the performance ends, I walk up to Wendy and Lulu to ask them how it went.
She likes to listen to herself. I think that's the problem. So, you know, she might have done a few peeps. Lulu, did you do a few?
Just a few peeps. Lulu cocks her head to the side. I wonder what she makes of all of this. I wish I could tell her story, too.
I think she gets mesmerized by the whole situation, and she hears the instruments playing, and she hears herself playing, and she's thinking, maybe I should just be listening.
In Berkeley, I'm Julia Haney for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. What is cancel culture? Is there really such a thing? Or does the phenomenon equate to a new kind of moral panic? KALW's Angie Coiro and her guest consider these questions in a new episode of Book It, our weekly look at Bay Area books and authors. Take it away, Angie.
Hana, a lot of people would not even ask whether cancel culture is a thing. It is so accepted. If college students protest a guest lecturer, it means they canceled her. Bill Cosby was canceled. Authors have been canceled. We hear it all the time. Stanford professor Adrian Daub questions some of those stories and the power they've had in our society. He's come to question, too, the backlash against cancel culture and its predecessors, political correctness and wokeism. We talked about his new book, The Cancel Culture Panic, How an American Obsession Went Global. And we started with definitions.
Not every time someone is deprived of attention or stature do we turn to the word cancel culture. Cancel culture comes with a couple of other kind of prerequisites that are never explicitly spelled out, but that are actually quite important. And part of why I think there is this, just this juncture between what's really happening, you know, in colleges, in media, et cetera, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, what's happening in media about the supposed problem of cancel culture is about the fact that we're not always totally forthright about what these other conditions are. It tends to be particularizing. We tend to speak of cancel culture if it's sort of young, woke lefties versus someone older, someone more established, someone more powerful than them, right? We tend to think of it as a kind of crisis narrative. This didn't used to happen as much as it happens now. Right? We've reached a crisis point. That's very, very important in that. If you just say, sometimes people overreact, not a very interesting story. No, people overreact more now than they did 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago.
They're making a mountain out of a molehill.
Exactly, exactly. And then the final thing is actually contained in, I like the way you took apart cancel on culture, in the cultural part, right? It may well be true that in our current moment, it is easier to fire people than it was 40 years ago, right?
Yes.
There are many reasons for this, right? I work in academia, I almost said I live in academia, which is also true. But no, I work in academia where, you know, the number or the percentage of tenured professors has gone down quite a bit over the last half century. And many of us work contingently. We're quite fireable, right? Think of media, another place where we get a lot of cancel culture narratives or cancellation narratives. Many people in media are a lot more insecure in their jobs than they were 40 or even 20 years ago. Now, what cancel culture as a narrative says is what matters is why did these young people get mad at this person online who then got fired?
Right.
Right? They don't ask, why was it so easy for that person to get fired after a bunch of young people got mad at them online? Right? The culture part of it is not innocent. It is really saying this is a cultural problem. It is a moral problem. We are too easily triggered, we are too soft, we are too coddled, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't say, well, okay, people on Twitter got mad. People on Twitter always get mad.
That's what they do.
It appears to be what it's for, right? Like no one's ever left Twitter with lower blood pressure than they opened the app with, right?
Asterisk. May I recommend Blue Sky?
Yeah.
Nice people there.
Yeah. Although I get my blood pressure up even on Blue Sky at this point. I think I just should not be hearing other people's opinions, to be quite honest. But when we frame that as a cultural problem, we say that it's the ease with which people are triggered, and we don't ask, well, how come that people being easily triggered translated so directly into professional consequences for someone? Well, that is itself a distortion or a prejudgment of what is really happening out there in the world. And it kind of telegraphs to you who's doing the storytelling here, right? Because if you say to me, well, I do think it's a problem that people are so easy to fire, what would you ask for? You'd ask for unions. You'd ask for job protections. You'd ask for government regulations. Well, a lot of people pushing the cancel culture narrative are libertarians. They don't like unions. They don't like government regulation. They don't like job protections all that much. They want to yell about the young wokesters online. They don't want to yell about Starbucks being feckless and letting go this person for no reason at all.
You know, actually, you made me really happy about that because I got to a point where I said, thank you, Adrian, when you actually drew a connective line between oil money and other industries that are behind this whole concept, not only of cancel culture, but its predecessors, political correctness,
yeah,
wokeness. And can you draw that thread together for us? Money and this attitude.
Yeah. There has been a cottage industry kind of trying to tell us that young people, often on college campuses, but now also on social media, are the problem. And it is often a very, very well-financed sort of system. And it is largely financed by people who don't really derive any benefit from us looking at who holds power and who holds financial wherewithal in the society. And it's much easier for them to kind of lodge that complaint in the kind of cultural sphere. This started really with right-wing millionaires and billionaires in the immediate post-war era, where the pitch to them was, you know, they're teaching communism on college campuses, start a foundation and bring free market principles to college campuses. They're imperiled there. You can't, everyone who leaves Yale now is a communist, basically. And,
right,
you know, this is, you know, the right-wing millionaires and billionaires, and I can't believe I'm saying this, were both kind of the perpetrators and the victims of this, right? Like these were hucksters getting money out of their pockets, right? These were people trying to get a cushy job paid for by some beer or oil or whatever magnate, right? And they were using the young people on the college campuses to do that. And we've had a long tradition of really a lot of our discourse about free speech, especially at universities, being dominated by these kinds of right-wing foundations, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that a good article about cancel culture will start with is an anecdote, maybe three. At Williams College, this happened. At Oberlin, this happened. And then here's a story about the New York Review of Books or whatever it is, right? And one thing, of course, we're never encouraged to do is to ask, well, why do I care about what happened at Williams College? And how do you know, right? And the how do you know, if you look carefully, it very often is the infrastructure put in place by these right-wing foundations. There are people whose job it is to monitor campus news wires or have people on campus who just write down, like, here's a dumb thing someone said at someone's talk, right? Two people came in shouting while this person was speaking, right? And then you see what you can do with it. You kick it up the chain and you see if this thing has legs. And sometimes it doesn't. And then everyone involved is very, very lucky. And sometimes it does have legs. And it ends up in, you know, the Wall Street Journal or in a comedy monologue or in a circular from the Heritage Foundation or something like that. So this is where these anecdotes eventually live and arrive. But in a way, we're never quite encouraged to ask, well, okay, so a bunch of sophomores at Oberlin were mad about the sandwiches. Why do I know about this? How did this get to me, right?
In other words, taking in media critically, which we're not good at.
Exactly, yeah.
I like the way you put it in part of the book. You said it's not that the institutions aren't necessarily more diverse. That's not really what they're being picked on for. And I'm quoting here, it's that they're not full-throated enough in defending monoculture.
Yeah.
And that's what's getting under people's hides.
Yeah, this is often forgotten, right? This is another one of these 40-year freakouts that I trace in the book. I was very amused to come across, you know, invocations of all the books that are allegedly no longer taught on college campuses, right? So they're, you know, you'll still see, today it's mostly tweets or whatever, but, you know, people will say, like, you know, you can no longer take classes in Shakespeare at universities. And you're like, well, you understand that course catalogs are openly available. You could check this out before you put it on the internet, but you can absolutely, you know, and you heard it here first, folks, take classes in Shakespeare at university, right?
But only at night when no one's looking.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, when the wokesters are asleep, yeah. But there too, the claim that Alice Walker is taught more than William Shakespeare at most universities, like, is a thing that you can read in 1988, 1987. It's really quite remarkable. We live with this idea that the classics are under attack, right? And one of the funny things about that, this is obviously a complaint about identity politics, is about the fact that the classics are getting displaced by, you know, these modish, right, feminist, queer, African-American, Asian-American literatures and pop cultures, right? That's what the complaint's about. The funny thing is, if you look at it historically, the first complaint wasn't about any of those. It was that white culture wasn't taught as white culture anymore, mm-hmm. right? Like under the Reagan administration, there was a big push in the Department of Education and elsewhere where they said, like, we are losing our identity as the United States, and that identity is European.
To your impression, was there some point at which this changed where it was authentic concern, albeit misguided concern, but authentic concern to a deliberate manipulation, or have those always existed side by side?
I think it's side by side. And I don't think that, you know, I mean, I think that there are absolutely cynical actors in this story I'm telling, but I don't know if most people in it are actually that cynical. I think that at the heart of a lot of stories of political correctness and today cancel culture are hurt egos, and I don't mean that to diminish it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, people being hurt, people who've taught at a university for many, many years, and suddenly they get pushed back on things they never got pushed back on, right? One might say, well, you got to live with that, but at the same time, I can see how that's tough.
That was KLW's Angie Coiro and her guest, Adrian Daub. Daub is a Stanford professor of humanities, and they discussed his new book, The Cancel Culture Panic: How an American Obsession Went Global. You can now find hour-long episodes of Book It at klw.org/bookit. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. Starting a local business comes with formidable barriers, especially for immigrants.
Y eso es lo que hacemos mucha gente inmigrante, como creamos nuestros espacios donde somos nuestros propios pues jefes y no.
She says this is just what many immigrants do, create their own spaces and become their own bosses.
Encouraging Entrepreneurship in Oakland. That's tomorrow morning at 11. Here's some music from a Bay Area band before we go. This is Hot Lung. They're playing Friday at Eli's Mile High Club in Oakland. Today's Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Crystal Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Ten, Smalley Blair Salyer, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trevney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.